Last week, a National Energy Board joint panel review issued a green light for the building of the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline. The proposed 1,200-kilometer, $8 billion pipeline would carry bitumen oil from the tar sands of Alberta to the northern coast of British Columbia. The ruling comes after 18 months of hearings in which First Nations environmentalists and BC municipalities expressed mounting concerns about the project. Ben West is a tar sands campaign director with Forest Ethics Advocacy, one of the leading organizations in the campaign to stop the pipeline. So, were you surprised by last week's ruling?
I would say I was disappointed, but not particularly surprised. The National Energy Board in its history has never actually rejected a pipeline before. That being said, this seems like if they ever were going to reject a pipeline, this would be the one to reject. You know, there was a record-breaking number of people who participated, close to 10,000 written submissions. The vast overwhelming majority were opposed. Even the government of British Columbia ultimately called for the pipeline not to be approved. You know, and so did many of the expert witnesses, and you know, all but two of the over 1,000 people who spoke during the oral submission. So we were hoping that the National Energy Board would come to a conclusion that this was not in the best interest of the people of BC or Canada, but unfortunately, they did not do that.
So this issue has been going on for a while, and maybe you could remind our listeners what's really at stake if the project does go ahead.
Well, this pipeline, you know, would bring about 500,000 barrels per day of, you know, some of the most toxic and carbon-intensive fuel on the planet to the West Coast, crossing over, you know, about 1,000 different streams and rivers, many of them salmon-bearing, crossing over the headwaters of the Fraser River, which is, of course, vital to, you know, the ecosystems of the West Coast, and ultimately pass through an area that's known as the Great Bear Rainforest, which is untouched, pristine rainforest in the north coast of British Columbia, and then would eventually make its way to Kitimat, where it would fill up tankers, about 225 super tankers, you know, carrying about 1 million to 2 million barrels of oil, you know, significantly more than was spilled by the Exxon Valdez, something like five times more minimum. And it would take it through the, you know, very dangerous waters of the Douglas Channel and the north coast of British Columbia. You know, it's an area that's pretty treacherous, you know, for vessels at the best of times, and you know, and when we see some pretty severe weather, it you know, can be very, very difficult. You know, so the likelihood of there being a spill at some point, you know, is relatively high, and you know, all it would take is one incident, whether it be into one of the, you know, rivers or tributaries within British Columbia, or you know, right on the coast, and it could have really profound impacts on the ecosystems, communities and local economy of British Columbia. So, you know, many people across the political spectrum, you know, feel very strongly that the pipeline shouldn't be built. And kind of on a grander scheme, it's become part of a larger conversation about Canada's role in the world as we try to deal with climate change. And, you know, of course, pipelines like this one would facilitate the expansion, you know, at a pretty rapid and unsustainable pace of, you know, the extraction of oil from the oil sands in Alberta. And, you know, we see that as also a reason to be concerned and, you know, part of this much larger conversation about, you know, what we should be doing as we, you know, struggle to fight what is, you know, one of the biggest threats facing humanity today.
So the joint panel review, though, did issue about 200 conditions attached to its recommendation of approval. Do these conditions alleviate any of your concerns about the project?
No. I mean, I think actually the good thing that's come out of those conditions is highlighting, you know, what we should be doing with the existing tanker traffic coming out of Vancouver Harbor. We've already seen an increase of tanker traffic coming out of Vancouver in the time since Kinder Morgan, this large American company, bought the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which has been how we brought conventional oil to the coast for many years. You know, so I think it, you know, while we're dealing with existing tanker traffic, definitely is good for us to take a look at, you know, what we're doing and what we could be doing a lot better to ensure safety. But I think, you know, for me and for, you know, most people who are concerned about this, really the only condition that we would have been happy about coming out of this would be an absolute rejection of the project. You know, there's nothing in there that reassures me that, you know, that we could avoid a spill indefinitely. I really think it's a matter of if, not when, a spill was to take place. And, of course, all it takes is one to create some pretty serious damage. And, of course, when it comes to the climate concerns that I raised, you know, there's no conditions in there that would address that. That climate wasn't even taken into consideration in the process. There's a lot of other reasons to be concerned about the Jarg Group panel's findings. You know, I think you see the 200 conditions, and it sounds very onerous, and it sounds like a big long list. But the truth is that actually a lot of the science and the concerns that were brought forward by experts is not very well reflected in the Jarg Group panel's findings. I think that's left a lot of people feeling pretty frustrated, given all the time and energy that went into pulling together that information and making it part of this process. What we've seen is that actually a lot of the very serious concerns have not really been taken to heart. Like, say, for example, the different properties of diluted bitumen, which is the particular kind of product that's being shipped out of Alberta, which we saw spilled in the Kalamazoo River and is even more difficult to clean up and deal with than a spill of conventional crude oil. Also concerns around whale habitat were drastically under estimated in terms of their level of concern. You know, many experts came forward, including those from the government of British Columbia, you know, highlighting the risk to orca and gray whales and humpback whales. Much of the critical habitat for these species, you know, would have these tankers passing right through it. And, you know, and the consequences, as we saw with spill like the Exxon Valdez, you know, can be quite severe to those populations. And when you see the way that that's characterized in the report, it, you know, to paraphrase one line, it basically says that, you know, even if there was an incident, it wouldn't really matter because the whales could just find new habitat, which really doesn't match up with our best understanding of science and definitely doesn't match up with the evidence that was presented in the hearing.
Now, oil companies have said that they've been working with First Nations to secure their support for this project and some of the other pipeline projects that are being presented across Canada. Recently, TransCanada Pipelines has hired former Assembly of First Nations President Phil Fontaine to promote its efforts, and Enbridge claims to have enlisted 26 First Nations who have signed equity agreements related to the project. How much resistance does this project continue to have among First Nations in British Columbia?
There's an overwhelming amount of opposition coming from First Nations. There's now 160 nations who've signed the Save the Fraser Declaration, which is a declaration banning the export of tar sands oil through their territories. There's actually no route through British Columbia now that doesn't cross through the territory of at least one, if not a number of signatories of this declaration. You know, we've got nations who've made it clear that they intend to bring this to the courts. And of course, you know, with the rights of First Nations people in Canada, you know, this could make its way all the way to the Supreme Court. In the history of Canada, there's over 400 projects that were canceled or abandoned as a result of land and title rights claims cases. And I think this could be another example of that. I don't doubt that there are some First Nations that are, you know, having serious conversations with these companies, and there's a lot of money on the table, and, you know, many of these communities are really between a rock and a hard place in terms of, you know, their ability to, you know, provide services and resources to their community members. And, you know, I think that that's, you know, totally understandable that those conversations would be happening, especially with the, when you see the government of Canada and, you know, and these very wealthy oil companies, you know, pushing something that, you know, often folks feel like it's kind of inevitable that the project will move forward. But I think there's many, many more First Nations who have made it very clear that they're not going to allow this project to proceed. And I find it very hard to imagine, given the overwhelming opposition on the ground from both Native and non-Native communities, that this project will ever actually be built.
You've actually said that Northern Gateway has the potential to end up making Clackwit Sound look like a walk in the park. What kind of civil disobedience do you expect if the project does attempt to go forward?
I'm hoping it doesn't come to that, but I can tell you that one of the number one questions I get asked over the years I've been working on this, you know, I'm approached by a lot of different people who sort of see the writing on the wall that Stephen Harper has been acting more like an advocate for these projects than he has been acting like a regulator. You know, folks, I think, don't have a tremendous amount of confidence in the federal government to do the right thing. time, especially given the changes that we've seen made to the environmental assessment process and the regulatory process. You know, I could understand why people feel that way. In terms of what kind of civil disobedience, I mean, I think that's yet to be seen. We're probably still a couple of steps removed from that. I think there's still the opportunity that, you know, that this project could be stopped in the courts. You know, it also could be stopped as a result of the next federal election, assuming that it's still an ongoing issue at that point. I really think, you know, civil disobedience is kind of an option that's out there if it gets to the point where Enbridge starts trying to, you know, actually get shovels in the ground. But I think they still have a number of hurdles to pass that are not going to be easy hurdles to pass. And given, you know, the unpopularity of the Harper government right now and the fact that all the opposition parties have a position against Enbridge, you know, I think given how close this election looks like it's going to be and D.C. looks like one of the really important battleground states, I think trying to push a project like this through in D.C., you know, could be one of the things that tips the scales against the Harper government.
So you've said that the Harper government has been acting more like an advocate for this project. Can you talk a little bit about some of the harassment environmental groups like yours have faced in relation to the federal government's promotion of the Gateway project?
You know, for much of this project, it's been pretty obvious to anybody who reads the newspaper that that the government of Canada under Stephen Harper and, you know, and these companies are basically singing from the same song sheet. You know, we're seeing the same talking points come up, you know, from industry and from government. And, you know, if you put together a laundry list of everything that the industry could ever want to try to get a pipeline approved, it seems like they've gotten basically all of it. You know, we've seen huge changes to the Fisheries Act, the Navigable Waters Act, you know, endangered species legislation, you know, the environmental assessment process, but then also, you know, op-eds from Joe Oliver, the Minister of Natural Resources, calling opponents radicals, you know, characterizing us all as enemies of the state. You know, there's been a systematic attack on the charitable status of any environmental group that has charitable status, you know, basically trying to silence their opponents. You know, and there's also these kind of arm's length entities that are, you know, sort of politically affiliated, you know, who quite aggressively go after, you know, the spokespeople for environmental groups, you know, whether it be with really nasty messages on social media or, you know, sort of op-eds and newspapers. You know, but there's this feeling of sort of a coordinated attack that, you know, kind of takes every different shape that a political campaign would, ranging from the sort of ad hominem attacks on your opponents to the, you know, all the different things that could be done, you know, using legislation to sort of make it easier for companies to succeed.
So what are the next things that people in here in Manitoba and across Canada should be doing to stay involved and stay to express their concerns on this issue?
Well, I think it's really important that people all across Canada let not only the Harper Conservatives but also the opposition parties know that, you know, we really do care about responsible resource development and that what Harper is doing is anything but that. You know, that people care about climate policy and that, you know, that this isn't just a BC issue. I also think just for anybody who cares about democracy in Canada, you know, we should be watching what's going on in BC very carefully. You know, the federal government is, you know, really bullying the province, I would say, at the moment, and has been pushing a project, you know, through that is very, very unpopular. You know, and I think that's just fundamentally undemocratic. And, you know, and I think, you know, folks in Manitoba or anywhere else in Canada should take a close look at the way that, that BC is being treated right now by the federal government and sort of imagine, well, what if a project like this was being proposed in our province and, you know, and our provincial government didn't support it and our population was overwhelmingly opposed to it? You know, would the federal government, you know, respect our right to self-determination or not? And I think that may have reverberations that go further and wider than even those with environmental concerns. You know, I think people who just care about democracy in Canada, if they really take a look at this, you know, will definitely be affected by it. So I think it's important for folks outside of D.C. to be, you know, speaking up and making sure that it's clear that this is an unacceptable way for a federal government to behave and that we would expect something different from the opposition. You know, there's still lots of opportunity to support First Nations in their legal defense. There'll definitely be fundraising efforts around that, as well as, many other opportunities for people to speak up. So, if you just keep a close eye on, on the mailing list of what groups like Forest Ethics, where I work, and others, are putting out there, we're kind of constantly asking for help on the different stages of the campaign, and there'll be much more of that to come in the years ahead.
Well, thanks so much. It sounds like we'll have a chance maybe to speak more about this in the years ahead.
Sounds good.
I've been speaking with Ben West, Campaign Director with Forest Ethics Advocacy. There's more information at forestethicsadvocacy.ca. You're listening to Mud & Water on CKUW 95.9 FM.